WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The slow speed of American government is deliberate. The founding fathers wanted it to be so, but that speed can cause problems today, a time in which everything except government seems to be accelerating. That can lead to frustration on the part of voters who want things done now. Our guest today argues that every democracy from Athens to Great Britain used the technology of their day to gather information for better governance. Further, he argues that using the information technology we have at our fingertips today, the best the world has ever known, can not only speed up the pace of government, it can help end gridlock. How? We're about to find out. John McGinnis served in both the Reagan and the first Bush administrations and is the George C. Dix Professor of Constitutional Law at Northwestern University. He is also the author of Accelerating Democracy, Transforming Governance Through Technology, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. Before we talk about how technology can help us pick up the pace of government, let me ask a really basic and maybe stupid question. Do we want it to speed up? As I mentioned, the founding fathers wanted the government to be deliberative and cautious, and they were kind of afraid of the masses out there. If we speed things up, are we going against what they had in mind?
I don't think so. The government needs to take decisions deliberately, but it also needs to take decisions that are necessary. And if the world is speeding up, that may require us to make quicker decisions. For instance, if there are weapons of mass destruction, we have no alternative but to make quicker decisions to address those. So the speed of the decision has to be proportionate to the speed of the danger we face. And there are going to be some perils that I think are going to come at us quite quickly, not only weapons of mass destruction, but perhaps new kinds of pollution from our technology. And so I do think that we have to have occasionally speedier decisions. I think the most important aspect of information technology, though, is to make better decisions by predicting what our policies are likely to do. We have a lot of policies that don't turn out the way politicians claim they will, and we need to prevent those kind of mistakes.
You mentioned in your introduction to the book that today the internet greatly facilitates betting pools, which you called information or prediction markets, that permit people to bet on the occurrence of future events. And such markets already gauge election results more accurately than the polls do, you say. So they could also foretell many policy results better than politicians or experts alone. You say that we could then better predict the consequences of changes in educational policy, on educational outcomes, or a stimulus program, on economic growth. Now, these online betting pools look at how people might vote for a particular candidate, at least the ones that I've been to. It's based on the number of people voting in a particular way. How could that be used to predict the outcome of different kinds of behaviors that would result from policies that many people would not even understand until they had been implemented and they had experienced them?
Well, that's right. Well, first of all, let me just explain a bit, if I might, the information markets. Mm-hmm. Those markets you do see in elections, and they've proved extremely accurate. The Iowa electronics market, it took bets from people on the election, not only on who would win, but on the vote margin. And that the vote margin that they predicted was more accurate than the average of polls on Real Clear Politics on the day before the election. And that's not a surprise, because these markets encourage people to put money where their mouth is. And so that's the advantage of these markets. Well, the questions of policy really aren't different in kind. They're about future events, like the economic rate of growth, and people can bet on those and predict those. Already, of course, politicians say that a stimulus program will create a certain number of jobs, will help economic growth. Well, we could have bets on that. People could bet against or for the politician on that kind of prediction, and therefore then we'd have better information. So it's really nothing. We're already doing the predictions, so everyone is predicting what people's behavior is in the future. The question is how accurately we can predict that. After all, voting behavior is behavior by people in the future, and these markets seem to foretell that better than the alternative.
Well, yeah,
of course,
but
that's all one can do.
But if you're going to use these betting markets to predict the outcome of an election, that's one thing, because you can say, I bet Obama will win, or I bet Mr. Romney would win tomorrow if they were doing this the day before. But if how would somebody say, well, I bet that, for instance, the Health Care Reform Act will be great for me and my family and for America, or be bad for me, my family, and America?
Well,
how would they know?
You have to have some metric, first of all. You just can't bet on whether it's good or bad. You have to bet on whether, for instance, whether one of the arguments was that it will reduce the rate of health care inflation. You could bet on that. You have to bet on something that one can reduce to a number, but politicians, and we're interested in such things. We're interested in the consequences of policy that can be reduced to a number. And so that really isn't very different from voting on election. I understand you say, well, people don't know about that, but people don't know the results of an election either. And yet, of course, all of our policy is based on predictions of how people are going to behave. So politicians and indeed experts implicitly and explicitly predict how people are going to behave. And the question is, can't markets improve those predictions? Because the advantage of markets is they have all the information that's available to politicians and experts, and they add in information. They add in information because people can evaluate the conflicting claims, and because they're incentivized by money, they're likely to make a better result. It's really not that different in kind from the stock market. People have to predict what's going to be the price of how a company is going to do in the next quarter, and that's what, or next year, next 2 years. That's what the stock market is, and that's more accurate than if you or I just decreed what we thought the value was. So that's the theory behind markets in general, and it's not different from a prediction market.
I will wager that there are people listening who are appalled by this idea. Why is money, why is the introduction of money to this so important? Why couldn't you just have a voting system, either on the internet or in some other way, where you just voted for or against something or predicted the outcome of something without the introduction of a wager?
Well, you want to distinguish two things. You want to distinguish people's preferences. Do they what is their preference for a program from what they actually think the program is going to do? The first is a preference. The second is a belief about the world. The fact is that we don't all have equally accurate beliefs about the world. Some people have more information than others.
Yeah.
And so we should vote on our preferences, but we should bet on our beliefs, because politics is about two things. One, it's about, of course, what kind of policies we prefer, but our preferences also depend on what the programs are going to do. Let's take an example of this, the stimulus program. The claim is that it's going to do a variety of things. That's an important aspect even of our preferences. So it's a good idea, independent of whether we just like it as an abstract matter, to know what it's going to do. And a market is better at gauging the effects of a policy than simply a poll, because a market encourages those with information, with those with knowledge, to participate rather than those who are uninformed.
Well, we are assuming that people have information if they're going to put their money at risk. But you can look at the stock market and see that people don't do that. They just put their money where they think it's going to be, and they take incredible risks sometimes to do what they do in the stock market.
Absolutely. But the reason they're willing to take that risk is they think they'll do better on average than not taking the risk.
Yes, but thinking and knowing are two different things.
That's certainly correct. The question is the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Mm-hmm. Is the stock market better than other mechanisms of evaluating value? And I think there's overwhelming evidence it is. Nations with stock markets do much better at allocating capital than those that do not. And so the question is not whether this market is perfect. The question is it better than the alternative? People's views that we don't have constrained by the discipline of market forces and by the discipline of losing money. I mean, people make predictions all the time about how policies are going to work out. They are often based on ignorance. Sometimes they're even based on things that are worse. They're based on whether this policy is good for me rather than accurately trying to gauge what the policy is going to do. What a prediction market does is it incentivizes, it gets an army of people in our politics who are only interested in the accuracy of their prediction because they're only going to be paid off if their prediction comes out. That's a great advantage. Mm. There are a lot of people, I don't want to shock you, who tried actually to mislead us in politics, who say things sometimes that are not actually completely truthful.
How about that? You know, but when complicated bills work their way through Congress, we have instances where Congress people, senators and congressmen, fail to read the legislation that they vote on because the legislation is 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 pages. If we can't trust elected representatives to read the legislation and know what it says before they vote yay or nay, how can we expect ordinary citizens to put their money at risk on policies and procedures that they probably won't read either?
Well, you have it slightly backwards
okay.
In the sense the fact that they have to put money to participate in these markets encourages them, indeed, in some sense, is a very strong encouragement to read the bills and figure out what the effects are. Indeed, that's again, I think you're actually underscoring a great advantage of these markets. I think you're absolutely right that politicians may not look at these bills, may not consider their effects. What an information market is brings an army of people who are working for us. Information in politics is just too scarce about what's going to happen. And we want to incentivize people to do this. Indeed, this will be a public benefit, unlike gambling on poker, or maybe even unlike the stock market, where the benefits go only or largely to the people who are the market participants. This kind of market benefits everyone in the nation because we're all benefited by having better information about policy.
Go ahead.
If I may just say that sure. I mean, we're all interested in what the government should produce, right, are mm-hmm. public goods that it's hard for the market and the family to provide, things like defense, things like environmental control, things like good economic policies that will benefit us by having economic growth. But we often are unsure about what those policies are going to be. Mm-hmm. And that means that information about those policies is itself a great public good. You might consider it the master public good. And what these markets do is give us that master public good without which all of our other goods that government really needs to provide will not be well provided. And so really, I think these markets are just one example, but an important example of what the new kind of information technology can deliver us.
I have 1,000 more questions, and we'll get some of them answered and get some of your questions answered as we go through the program as well. Our guest today is John McGinnis, professor of constitutional law at Northwestern University. He worked in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. His book is called Accelerating Democracy, Transforming Governance Through Technology. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Honda Hickory, offering new and certified pre-owned Hondas to the Charlotte Metro and Western North Carolina area on Highway 70 in Hickory and at HendrickHondaHickory.com. And North Carolina Dance Theater presenting Jean-Pierre Bonfou's Peter Pan, Escape to Neverland, with this high-flying ballet with new sets and costumes March 7th through 17th at Knight Theater. Tickets at ncdance.org. Tiempo Libre is a Cuban band that likes to mix classical music with Cuban timba music, and that dual personality is a result of their upbringing and training, studying classical music at Cuba's rigorous conservatories by day and playing in clubs at night. They've fled Cuba for artistic freedom, reunited in the United States, and now these three-time Grammy nominees are playing with the Charlotte Symphony. We'll meet them and talk about their music and what they plan to do here tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Reaton Show, government agencies are finding new reasons to use drones at home, but many worry about their potential misuse. Debate over Big Brother in the Sky.
Join us for the Diane Reaton Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. John McGinnis, our guest, professor of constitutional law at Northwestern University. His book is called Accelerating Democracy, Transforming Governance Through Technology. We've been talking about these information markets and these, I guess, betting pools to judge or gauge or predict or help Congress decide on what to vote on in terms of policies and procedures going on down the line. And to make this happen, you want Congress to legalize online internet gambling so for-profit prediction markets can work. Could they do that without legalizing online poker, worldwide online poker, or would that just be part of it?
Oh, I think they absolutely could do that without legalizing poker. You'd have to say that there's a bona fide a public policy focus of the market, and I don't think poker qualifies or even
What's the difference? I mean, you're gambling on something, so what's the difference?
Right. Well, but the difference is the statute can define the difference. You're saying people are putting their money at stake, but as I suggested before, the big difference is gambling on poker only satisfies a private vice.
Mm-hmm.
Putting your market on predictions about the consequences of policy gives a public benefit by generating this information. So there's a huge justification for the government to make that distinction.
So what kind of person or personality would be attracted to this kind of thing where they would be willing to read policies and potential laws and then vote on them using money to do so? What kind of a person would do this?
Policy experts. One could even think at some point, if these markets became quite liquid, even hedge funds of experts, people who really feel they know more than others. Those are the people who will be incentivized to put their money in.
But would would this be rank and file citizens, or would this be representatives of corporations who have phalanxes of attorneys reading these bills and saying, well, this is going to help our company, so we'll vote for it?
They're not voting. They're putting their money on the prediction. And if they have a bad prediction, they're going to lose their money.
Actually,
I know your question implies, well, maybe these corporations will try to manipulate the mm-hmm. market. That's always a worry about markets, but there's a lot of evidence. You know, if you try to manipulate the market, essentially you're a sheep because you're not trying to get an accurate result. So you're giving more money for the wolves, in other words, the people who want accuracy, to come in the market and win that money. So actually, manipulation is extremely difficult in a market like this.
So these people would not be voting on these policies. The Congress would still be voting.
Absolutely, Congress is voting.
But they would be pushing Congress toward one decision or another, because they would say, yes, this policy will work, or no, this policy won't. Therefore, vote on it or don't, or vote yes or vote no, right?
Right, they'll have it, but all information. I mean, we at the moment we have all sorts of people who are special interests who go and try to influence Congress. It'd be useful to have a market that that I think offers a better and more accurate prediction. Let me be clear: it's not a perfect prediction. It's largely with these prediction markets; it's a matter of probability. And so, some politicians, of course, will ignore the market, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Of course, if they continue to ignore it and the market seems to be as accurate as election markets are, voters might want to take that into account and whether they want to reelect a politician who votes for policies that don't deliver even what the policy says it should be delivering, like economic growth or something the politician claims the policy is going to deliver, but the markets say it won't.
So how does this speed up governance?
Does it speed up governance? I'm not quite sure that. I think the more important question of than speeding up governments is making a government more accurate to have a better policies. In the sense, it does speed up governments in this sense that insofar as we have better predictions of policy and have better policy, we don't have to kind of backtrack and change our policies as often as we would otherwise do. So in that sense, it certainly speeds up government.
Let's go back to the previous election. You say that these information markets universally and correctly foretold President Obama's win over Mitt Romney in the election, while respected pundits failed. One of those pundits, however, Karl Rove, nearly had a meltdown on Fox News on election night when they told him that Obama had won. He disputed that because he believed that he had information that said otherwise. It was impossible for Obama to have won, given what he thought he knew. So why was his election information data, which came from vast numbers of people, less accurate than these betting pools?
Well, came from fewer people because the markets have a lot more people. And then also one of the advantages of markets, as I said, is people's money is on the line. In people advising a politician, all sorts of things are on the line rather than their money, their relationships. There's also well known a kind of optimism bias of partisans. Partisans think they're going to win. I think that's probably happened with Karl Rove. That markets get rid of those biases. They're not perfect. There may still be, we see bubbles in markets, but informed traders are going to be less biased. They're going to be less taken by partisan biases, and that's why the markets were much better than Karl Rove at predicting the results of the election.
And you have said that these prediction markets can help answer a fundamental question of democracy. How can America know what Americans No.
Right.
But how do you distinguish between what Americans know and what Americans think or hope or believe?
Well, that's an excellent question. As I said, the markets are only better than the alternative. So in that sense, they give us a better probability of predicting the future, but what they do is they do something that's extremely important and what markets do generally. There's a lot of dispersed information out there. You have a bit of information, I have a bit of information, and if we accumulate that information, we're more likely to have knowledge. Of course, what knowledge is true belief, so our belief is more likely to be true. I'm not saying it's always going to be true, but it's more likely to be true, and it's more likely to be true because we're accumulating all of this knowledge in a disciplined way.
John O. McGinnis is our guest. He's a former member of the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, a professor of constitutional law at Northwestern, and his book is called Accelerating Democracy, Transforming Governance Through Technology. If you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org/CharlotteTalks. We'll get to, and put your money on the line, because that way we'll get better questions and better information. You would have markets guide government policy. Is this an example or another example of letting markets make decisions unfettered, letting them take the lead without government intervention? In fact, letting markets set government policy instead of the other way around?
Well, it's certainly using government to guide policy. As I say, I'm going to be very clear here. Politicians and voters will still be making the decisions. This is just a mechanism to guide them. But it is a way of helping markets guide governments, because markets are going to be useful in this sense. I want to be clear. This is about predicting what actually policies do, and there's reason to believe that markets are better at that, just as they're better at a variety of things. I mean, I'm sort of unapologetic about markets over the course of history. They're the reason we're sitting with so much greater prosperity than people were 300 years ago, because they've been allocating capital to good inventions, to good ideas that have made us much better off. So I'm certainly not going to apologize for markets. They've been a tremendous benefit to mankind.
So it brings collective wisdom to the decision-making process, above and beyond the...
Right, in a disciplined way. I mean, certainly there is a collective wisdom in just people voting. I don't deny that. But these markets are better for the results of policy, because actually people's knowledge is very unequal in society. So everyone's preferences should count equally, but not everyone's knowledge is equal. Mm-hmm. And that's what the market helps. It helps us distinguish between preferences and information.
Your model here requires money, because you think people should put their money where their mouth is. It also requires access to technology, because this would be done, I guess, on the internet or some kind of a device and transmitted on the internet. So what about those people who don't have money and do not have access to technology? Are they left out of this equation? Should they be?
People who don't have money would be less likely to bet. That's also true of the stock market. That doesn't suggest that the stock market's inaccurate because of that. Again, it's very important that people without money be able to vote, but it's not so important. We don't need to have everyone participate in a market for the market to be accurate. We need a lot of people to participate, but it's not dependent on people without money, unless you thought that people who were very poor would likely have a differential knowledge of how policies are going to come out. They'd really know how that was going to do in a way other people would not. I think that's just not likely as a factual matter.
I mean, we see a lot of people without money gambling in Vegas and Atlantic City and some of these places around Charlotte and around the state, although it's not legal.
Right. I tend to think this market would not attract such people, because I don't think they would be very interested in the kind of questions that this market would pose.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take a couple of phone calls from listeners and begin with Mark in Charlotte. Mark, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Hey, very interesting idea. I was just sitting here wondering, and I appreciate that markets are maybe the best option, but what are your thoughts about the behavioral psychologists, behavioral economists that say, hey, you know, people really aren't really that rational with their money, and that's your basic premise, is people are going to act in their self-interest with money. And if this thing scaled up, would you get the same results? That's basically my question.
Well, that's a great question. There's evidence that actually people, though, who participate in the stock market are much more less subject to these biases that behavioral economists suggest that many people have, because after losing money, these biases tend to be screened out, as people don't participate in a market that they consistently lose in. So I don't want to say that there'll be no biases in these markets, but again, I think the most important points that my book tries to get across, other than the importance of technology and markets, is what I call the Nirvana fallacy. It's just because there may be some imperfections in a government structure doesn't mean we should use it if it's better than the alternatives. We're not going to have perfection in government, and if this is a mechanism that's better at predictions than just relying on experts or just on politicians or just on special interests, we should use it, even if there are these imperfections that behavioral economists quite correctly point to, but that I think we see, at least in professional markets, tend to be screened away.
Does that answer your question, Mark?
Yeah, that was good.
Okay, thank you for your call. Let's go to Will in Charlotte. You're on WFAE. Will, welcome.
Hello. I just this is a really cool topic, and I just wanted to make a quick comment. I had just a few months ago, I read a book by Nate Silva called "The Signal and the Noise." That also it had a couple chapters on prediction markets of this sort, and it's very interesting because he gets a really much more so than you guys could do in a show. He gets a lot into the statistical arguments for why they are so high quality and why they make good, accurate estimates. And I just wanted to make a quick comment to anyone else interested.
Okay. Nate Silver is also the fellow who does the, I think it's 538.com website, which has been relatively very accurate, 100% accuracy so far in predicting a couple of the outcomes of presidential elections. And I think he's also handicapping the Oscars at the moment. What do you think of his method versus your method?
I do think that's a good method. I think he's lying less on prediction markets than on what I would call big data, which my book talks about as well, about creating models. And I think that's another useful method of predicting the future. What I would say is, of course, people who use those models, and of course, Nate Silver's information is available online, people can look at that, and that informs their betting. And so I see those kind of models working together with prediction markets. I don't see any inconsistency in praising Nate Silver for his statistical model and saying we should have prediction markets to mediate, because other people had statistical models for the election that didn't work out quite as well
right.
as Nate Silver's. And so we shouldn't, it's a mistake just to look retrospectively and say, therefore, models are better than the prediction market. There are going to be some models that are going to work very well, others that won't. The prediction market can mediate between them. If I may say, one other matter that I think that Silver's use of a model suggests is how important artificial intelligence, another technology that I discuss at length in my book, can be, because artificial intelligence may help us build models for predictions that humans alone could not. And I think that's a reason that government and I'm very pleased to see that the president has this policy in the State of the Union that is putting government money behind mapping the human mind. It'll help for diseases of the human brain, but it's also going to help in spurring artificial intelligence, which in turn helps us predict policy better.
And again, Will, Nate Silver's book is called The Signal and the Noise, right?
Yes,
correct.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
People complain that Washington is broken, and that's evidenced by the gridlock we're seeing in Congress between Democrats and Republicans and between moderate Republicans and Tea Party Republicans. No one wants to give an inch. You believe this can be fixed through technology, and you talk about information technology giving us empirical evidence of the outcomes of policies before they are implemented. But we live in a culture now where people seem to loathe to be swayed by empirical evidence when it clashes with their preconceived beliefs. They don't trust science, they don't trust statistics, and that includes the politicians voting on these things. You have to overcome that, don't you, before information technology can be of any use? How do you accomplish that?
Absolutely. You need to make information more decisive in politics. And I have a whole set chapter that discusses that. You're discussing the problem of bias in politics.
Mm-hmm.
We have partisans who really don't update on information. And that is a tremendous problem in politics. But it's not the case that everyone is similarly partisan. People change their minds based on information. One of the interesting things, for instance, was the military became less sympathetic to, which is generally very Republican-oriented electorate. Oh, I'll come back and talk about that after the break.
Okay. All right. We can do that. John McGinnis is professor of constitutional law at Northwestern University, former member of the Reagan and H.W. Bush administrations. His book is called Accelerating Democracy, Transforming Governance Through Technology. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Signature Healthcare, celebrating 10 years of offering concierge medical care, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, personalized executive health care, and same-day appointments. 704-554-8787. And Sherpa Project Management, experienced project and change managers, business analysts, and program managers for critical business and technology initiatives. Charlotte headquartered and online at SherpaLLC.com. Government agencies and private companies foresee many good reasons to use unmanned remote-controlled aircraft in our skies here at home. But some say adequate safeguards need to be established first. The debate over domestic drones, the topic of the conversation at 10 in 20 minutes on The Diane Rehm Show. Join our conversation at 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, or online.
WFAE has a challenge for you. Last fall, you eliminated 5 days of our fundraiser by responding to our request to pledge early. We want to do it again and are encouraging you to pledge today to help shorten the upcoming spring pledge drive. Every dollar brought in before the drive will go towards the goal of $550,000. And for every $55,000 raised, we'll eliminate a day. Pledge your support at WFAE.org and be automatically entered in our giveaway to the French Riviera.
We're back, and our guest is John O. McGinnis. Accelerating Democracy, Transforming Governance Through Technology is the name of his book. You can reach us online, by the way, at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We interrupted you in the middle of making a point about the military and how all this kind of information flow changed their minds.
Well, the Republicans seem less competent in prosecuting the wars, and so actually information did change the military, which had a predilection for Republicans. And so the question is, how do we structure our government to make these biases less decisive in politics? And the way we do it, I think, is to make moderate voters more decisive, because partisans are less likely to update on new information. And the way we do that, I think, is with reform against partisan gerrymandering, with top two primaries in which everyone can run, and then we take the top two people, and that means that even a Democratic district, that Republicans and moderates and independents can still be decisive when the two Democrats face off in the general election. So there are ways we can structure our society, structure our electoral system to make information make a greater difference. And
How do you do that in this world in which we live, which has been structured this way deliberately and has resulted in this partisan gridlock?
Well, actually, we are seeing a move to anti-gerrymandering legislation happen in California. There's actually some in Florida as well. So there's actually been a movement, and I do think it we need to build on that movement. Another thing that I think we've actually seen is ending earmarks. Earmarks are also make it hard for the polity to update on policy, because what they tend to focus on is who an incumbent who can bring home the bacon, who can bring home pork to his district, becomes insulated from challenge, even if he's voting for just his party's policies that aren't working. And so I think getting rid of earmarks was also a very good move to make our politics more responsive to new information. So actually, I see some green shoots in this regard that are going to pay off in the future.
Would a shift toward what you're advocating here solve the problem that we experienced in the last election, particularly in the last election, although all candidates through time have probably put out inaccurate and completely untrue facts in the course of campaigning? This race, this past race, seemed to be particularly egregious in this area, where we have stretching the truth, exaggerating the facts, making up facts, and ignoring the facts, and saying out loud, facts are not going to get in my way. If you go to your system, will that stop?
I think it'll help. I would say I'm not at all sure it's worse in this election than previous elections. You go back to the 19th century, there were a lot of just huge lies in politics. But I do think it helps. And one way it's going to help, if I may go back to prediction markets, psychologists tell us that one way to de-bias people, to make people less biased, is to force them to think of the alternative. And what prediction markets do is they force people to bet conditional? Well, if, for instance, we could have a market conditional on Obama winning, what's the economic rate growth rate going to be? Conditional on Romney winning, predict the economic growth rate. Just thinking through the alternatives, what's going to happen if Obama wins? What's going to happen if Romney wins? Actually, psychologists will tell us, helps people be less biased.
But there was a lot of talk about that before the last election, and a lot of partisan Republicans claimed doom and gloom if Obama won because of his, quote, socialist policies, end quote, and some of his plans for America. And the other side said the opposite, of course. So what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that the elections are not won in America just by getting your partisans. You've got to get people in the middle. I absolutely agree with you that for some people, politics is really like a religious belief. No amount of evidence is going to change their minds.
Yeah.
But that's not the case, right? And things change over time. People move from one party to another based on information. And my argument is we may need to have better information to make those movements, because then I think more people will move and also will move more quickly to a better equilibrium in politics. That's the argument for more information. It does not depend on everyone being unbiased, just a middle or just a segment of the electorate switching sides.
Let's take another call from Martha in Charlotte. Welcome, Martha.
Hi, Mike. Professor McGinnis, you raised some really interesting ideas, and of course, I'm not opposed to technology, but the kinds of things you're talking about seem very anti-democratic in a system where we are already fairly anti-democratic, in that big money already controls the outcome of elections, and big money, certainly with, you know, recent Supreme Court decisions and lower court decisions put together, sort of determine that money goes with the winning candidate. And I just can't begin to tell you that to exacerbate what we already have by sort of maintaining that we need to have these prediction markets or maintaining that those are the best ways to measure public opinion. I just can't help but think that that's going to exacerbate, which is this problem of the, you know, what Schottschneider would have called the heavenly choir singing with this upper class bias. How do you bring democracy back with the kinds of things that you're suggesting?
Yes, I just don't think, if I may respond, I just don't think that's the case. These markets don't only change people's preferences insofar as they predict the consequences of policy, what economic growth is going to be. It doesn't matter the fact if indeed people who are somewhat wealthy predict in these markets or are participating in these markets, because they'll lose money if they predict wrongly. So this isn't going to bias democracy more towards the wealthy. It's going to bias democracy more towards accurate policies. So
well,
that's the difference here. It's just not the case that this is like a campaign spending. I don't think I agree with you on campaign spending either, but this isn't like campaign spending at all, because the object of these markets is to predict the results of policy, not to say what people's preferences should be. And voters then are still completely free. They still have their ballots to vote however which way they want. They'll just be better informed. But as we see, because these markets prove more accurate than other ways of predicting policy.
Well, So let's say that the wealthy want to predict how well off they're going to be in the future. So what they're going to do is they're going to, I mean, potentially predict for things that they think are going to make them money in the short term, rather than things that are going to make them money in the long term. Or they will predict for policy, good policy, you know, normatively good policy. They're going to predict for policies that are bad.
Yeah. How do you prevent or reduce or eliminate market manipulation in this case, particularly when you have to have money to play?
Well, the argument is that people who go in trying to predict things that are inaccurate, right? they are giving opportunities for other people to make money. And in our society, one of the advantages, actually, of a market society is people who could raise money even for a company was based on these kinds of predictions. And they would have every incentive then to take money from the manipulators. The manipulators are actually people who are offering money to be taken in the markets because they're trying to do something that's inaccurate, and they're giving more money to people who are going to make more accurate predictions. So in some sense, they're making the market work better.
Oh, you know, let me throw out another thing. The markets are really accurate. And in fact, if you look at public policy sort of history, there's a variety of scholars who suggest the efficient markets hypothesis, that companies are going to, their stock market rates are going to go up, for example. That's an example of an efficient market. When they think that a regulation the government's going to pass is going to hurt their competitor. You know, there's research on cotton markets and regulations, and there's research. Heck, I've done research on broadcasting history and found that the broadcasting companies that wanted regulation back in the 1920s, when regulation was said to be passed, their markets went up because they thought it was going to hurt their competitor. So, yeah, the markets are really efficient, but they're efficient in a way that may not be good at predicting what's best public policy outcome.
I'm afraid that's just not the case. I mean, the markets you're talking of, they're trying to predict the price of their stock. Here we're actually trying to predict things like economic growth. So it's not a question of trying to hobble your competitors. You're trying to predict some metric that's important to everyone.
Martha, thank you for your call. She started out by calling this anti-democratic, and that may be because we have not talked about the other piece of this, the other side of this. You say that we need to transition from trickle-down analysis and plans handed down from politicians and planners and bureaucrats to a system that allows information to bubble up from the bottom, I guess, from the masses. Are you talking about crowdsourcing here, essentially?
No, I'm actually talking again about prediction markets. I mean, again, the alternative, of course, is not relying on the predictions of everyday citizens about policy. Most citizens don't think, quite understandably, about policy. They've got much better things to do. We rely generally on experts and on politicians and on special interests. So markets, in that sense, are more democratic. They're much more encompassing of individuals than simply experts or politicians.
But how do you make these markets not composed of special interests?
Well, again, there may be special interests that participate in these markets. The difficulty is that they have something at stake, because a special interest without a market can go and lie and say something about a policy that's just not true. It's a result that isn't going to happen. They don't pay any penalty. But if they say something, if they participate in these markets and try to spin the market to a result that actually they don't believe is accurate, they have to put up money. And so there's a price to be paid. And so it's better than, again, the alternative we have today, in which special interests absolutely try to manipulate policy, but they don't pay any price.
We have an email from a listener named Dan. He says, seems as if prediction markets work well on one-off events, yet when they are used internally in organizations to substitute for management decisions, they are difficult to sustain. For example, using prediction markets to pick new business ideas or product ideas, they tend to have low liquidity and people tend to lose interest in them. What do you say to that?
Well, absolutely. The question of liquidity is important. Of course, one of the advantages of a prediction market on policy, I think it's likely to get a lot more interest than just a few people in a company. My book actually suggests that if we need to have more interest, the government might actually, in some sense, subsidize these markets, might experiment with not forcing people to pay taxes on their winnings. Again, that's because these markets have so many public benefits, and that would create more liquidity in the market. But I think the difference between this and a market that's just internal to a company that only a few people can participate in is that the kind of issues, economic growth from the stimulus package, are just going to interest a lot more people.
The founding fathers were afraid of the masses. That's why we had senators elected by state legislators for years and years and years. So would this move us farther afield toward true majority rule and away from representative government if we did it this way?
I don't think so, because representatives would be still casting the votes, but it would be another way of disciplining representatives. In that sense, I think the framers would like it, because they were worried about the self-interest of everyone, including the self-interest of representatives. And the question is, how do we discipline their self-interest? Mm-hmm. And this is a way of disciplining self-interest by actually calling on the self-interest of people in making money. And so it's very much a framer's idea. I hadn't really thought of that. It's to use one kind of interest to constrain another kind of interest. And that is, in some sense, the genius of our constitutional system.
You talk about how a more dispersed media, bloggers, the internet, the Twitterverse, even the Tea Party and online movements can be used to improve government. But right now it seems that those are the things that have led to a major divide in the country and an immovable group of factions and gridlock in Washington.
I don't think so. I don't think that's what's led to it. I think there have been these factions before. I think the advantage of this more diverse media structure is that actually we get the advantage of a lot more expertise in our mainstream media. Reporters' beat now isn't only going out on the pavement, but is looking at blogs of true experts. Even newspapers have blogs of experts. And so I think we actually get a lot more expertise. We got a lot more hypotheses about what government's policies are going to do. And then my book suggests we need to have ways of testing them. Mm-hmm. The prediction markets is one way, but I suggest other ways as well.
Among them, greater federalism.
Greater federalism, because that allows us to test how policies work in different areas. And also, I think the federal government should sometimes randomize policy, should put one kind of policy with respect to one company and another with another company and see what works in that way. So there are a lot of ways of doing that, but we need to have experts in the blogosphere offering hypotheses about what policies are going to do. So I see this, again, as very much interconnected.
I wanted to ask you where we start, where we dip our toe in the water. And if you can do it in 10 seconds, you can do it, but if not, you can't.
Well, I think we begin by having an information program which is bipartisan in Washington.
Okay. John O. McGinnis. His book is called Accelerating Democracy, Transforming Governance Through Technology. He's a professor of constitutional law at Northwestern University and worked in both the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. Thanks for the hour.